Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here, but it's not a pleasure to work for this type of organization. We're looking forward to going out of business, but I'd like to speak a little bit, a few things about the work that we do at ORA, and things that the Jewish community can do to try and resolve the issue. My name is Jeremy Stern. I'm a musmach of REITs, and I'm the director of ORA, the Organization for the Resolution of Agonot. ORA was founded in 2002 by a group of YU students, and since then, in close to 10 years, we have assisted in the resolution of 168 Aguna cases throughout North America and Europe. So that's the good news. The good news is we've resolved many, many cases. The bad news is that at any given time, we're working on about 70 Aguna cases throughout North America and Europe. We're also the sole partner for the Rabbanut, the chief rabbinate of Israel, for the situations where a recalcitrant party is no longer in Israel and outside of their jurisdiction, and so we take on those types of cases. Now I'm going to talk about three topics. No, we'll wait till close the door. We'll talk about three topics. The first, and I understand we just have a few minutes, so I'll try and make it short. Three topics. The first is the types of cases that ORA takes on, the work that we do to resolve current Aguna cases. The second issue will be the role of Rav Shachter as our posek and some Piskei Din that he's written for some of our cases. And the third topic will be the importance of the prenup, the halachic prenuptial agreement. But I have three points just to make beforehand, before I get to those three specific topics. The first point is that we'll talk about agunot, and people might ask about, what about agunim, right? Situations where it's the other way around, a wife refuses to receive the get. So the vast majority of cases that we've worked on, about 98% of our cases, have been situations where a husband refuses to issue a get. About 2% of our cases have been situations the other way around, where a wife refuses to receive the get. So considering these are the vast, vast majority of our cases, just for simplicity's sake, we'll talk about the agunot problem. That's point number one. Point number two is that from our perspective, the get should be issued unconditionally and unrelated to any other issues of the divorce. What we advocate for is for a get to be issued unconditionally and in a timely fashion. And so people will say, well, I know a situation where there was an issue with custody, visitation, or finances. The wife did this, that, the other thing. What we say is that if you have any disagreements with regards to finances, with regards to custody or visitation, there are many fair forums that one could go to adjudicate those issues. You can go to civil court, you can go to Beit Din, you can go to a mediator or an arbitration panel, but the get must be issued unconditionally, unrelated to any other issues of the divorce. Now, from a halachic perspective, there is the Ramah. The Ramah holds that the get should be the last order of business so that it's not issued with any sort of assumed conditions of the husband. So there might be a question of the timing of the get, at what point in the divorce process the get is issued, but under no circumstances can the get be issued as a bargaining chip or conditionally. So that's point number two. And point number three is that withholding of a get is not only problematic from a halachic perspective, but also from a social and ethical perspective. What we feel is that withholding a get is a form of domestic abuse. Abuse at its core is about control. It's one person controlling the life, the future, the freedoms of another. Domestic abuse is not just about black and blue marks, but there is financial abuse, there is psychological abuse, emotional abuse, social abuse. There are all sorts of abuses that one person can commit against the other, and that's really at its core is about one person controlling the other person. And so withholding a get is no different. And so not only is it halakhically problematic to hold a get, but also it's simply abusive. So in terms of the work that we do at ORA, this is part one, and I'll do this quickly. So the work that we do at ORA, as I said, we're working on about 70 active Aguna cases, and our caseload is only growing as we become more well-known throughout the Jewish community. So we take on cases really in three, well, this is all groups of three types of situations. A type A case is sort of the clearest cut situation from a halachic perspective. There are cases where a Beit Din has, the Beit Din process has gone its course, and a Beit Din has issued a psak, a ruling, or a seiruv, an order of contempt against a recalcitrant party. And the wife has done everything she can from the Beit Din process. She turned to the Beit Din, and the husband refused to comply with the Beit Din, and now they've issued a written psak or seiruv against him. And so Ora plays a critical role within the Jewish community in that we are the enforcement agents of the Beit Din. We are there to enforce the psak of the Beit Din when the Beit Din has now confirmed that the husband is recalcitrant. What we do whenever we take on a case, we always try and resolve things amicably at first. That means opening lines of communication between the two sides, facilitating the Beit Din process. So I'll just give you an example of a case that we worked on. The wife was waiting for a get for 15 years. But one of the reasons she's waiting for a get for 15 years is she never spoke with the guy. They had a short marriage, and afterwards he literally went to Taiwan, and they had no communication whatsoever. And it just required a third objective party to be in the center and open lines of communication between the two sides. Sometimes the husband won't speak with the wife won't speak with the husband. And in this case, that was the situation. We called up the husband, and he said, "I want a box of pictures from our daughter from 20 years ago, and you know we want the get to be issued unconditionally, but this was, you know, sometimes we have to be a little bit pragmatic." And so here she was willing to give up the pictures from the box of pictures from 20 years ago, and we had to arrange a get in Taiwan, and so that involved a lot of technical details. In yeshiva day schools and in Beis Yaakov, they don't teach people how to get divorced, and so often women are really confounded by the process and don't know how to move on, and so we're there to guide them through that process. So to arrange the get in Taiwan was a bit of an issue, and so that was a case that was resolved. So we always try and resolve things amicably at first, or it might involve working on a negotiated settlement for all the other issues between the two parties, and again for the get to be issued separately or unconditionally. But in a case where we've exhausted all forms of amicable resolution to the case, then we resort to using all civilly legal and halakhically permissible forms of pressure that we can. What are called harchakot de Rabbeinu Tam, the sanctions of Rabbeinu Tam. So that includes social and communal pressure, and also there's legal and financial pressure. So social and communal pressure means turning to the husband's family and friends to ostracize him and to pressure him and to isolate him, to say that we will not invite you to family simchas, you're not invited for Shabbos, you're not welcome in shul, or to get kibudim in shul, to apply that type of social pressure. And communal pressure is just on a larger scale. We organize peaceful demonstrations at the homes of recalcitrant parties to state, as a community, we will not tolerate this form of abuse within our midst. So that's social and communal pressure. And then there's legal and financial pressure. We use all legal tactics that we can. So we have attorneys who volunteer their time pro bono to represent the women. And so in some particularly egregious cases, we've sued the husbands for the intentional infliction of emotional distress, which is a tort. And so we sue the husband for damages, for the emotional damage that he's inflicted against his wife for refusing to give her a get for 10 years. He now owes her, we claim, let's say $200,000. And so first of all, he doesn't want to litigate that in court. And she has pro bono representation, so it comes to her for free. And so he'd have to hire an attorney. So it's not worth his time to fight it. And it's really not worth his time if he has to pay the sum. So we say, well, drop the charges as long as you give the get. So that's the financial perspective and legal perspective. In particular cases, we might be able to hold the husband in contempt of court. So those are some financial and legal pressures. Whatever we can, every case is unique, and we'll see what we can do to resolve the case. So that's type A. Type A, just to go back, are situations where the Beit Din process has run its course, the Beit Din has issued a psak, has made it very clear that the husband is a recalcitrant husband, the wife is an aguna, and therefore the community should do whatever it can to pressure him to give the get. That's type A. Type B cases become a little bit more contentious, or often more contentious, in terms of the process. Those are situations where the Beit Din process has failed or stalled for whatever reason. Not every Beit Din is the Beit Din of America, and so not every Beit Din has published rules and procedures about how they govern themselves and how they operate. And so not every Beitin is, and this is something that I've spoken with Rav Shachter about a number of times, is particularly scrupulous. And so we have problems in the Beitin process, and we'll get to a case a little bit later on, where the Beitin process just stalled for 3 years, and it was not moving at all. And so we get involved in those types of cases. And those cases in particular, we'll turn to Rav Shachter and say, there's no psak from Beitin. There's no seiruv, there's nothing. But the wife has been waiting for X number of years, and X, Y, and Z has happened. And so Rav Shachter will weigh in on the case and state whether or not we can still apply pressure and the wife is an aguna. So that's type B cases where the Beitin process has failed or stalled and has not run its course. And type C cases, the third type of case that we work on, are situations where there's really no chance for a credible Beitin process. So we have a case in Wyoming or something, and the couple's not religious, so there's no local Orthodox rabbi we can go to. I don't know if there are local Orthodox rabbis in Wyoming. Maybe there are, but I'm just saying, in a hypothetical case, if there is no local Orthodox rabbi, and there's certainly no local Beit Din that the wife can go to, so there's Chabad everywhere. It's true. But if there's nothing else if there's no real chance for a credible Beit Din process, we might get involved in that case again. And again, we'll deal with the legal and halachic ramifications of the case. So those are the types of cases that we get involved in, and the type of work that we do. Second part that I'd like to discuss is Rav Shachter's role as the posek for Ora. So here we can turn to your packet. Does everyone have a packet? Does anyone not have a packet? That's a better question. Okay. Might be up front.
And if not, it's okay.
Okay. You can share. So they're a little bit out of order, but what I have copied here are in Hebrew, and two of them are in English as well, Piskei Din that Rav Shachter has written for specific cases that we've worked on. And many of the conversations that I have with him are Baal Peh. He doesn't write things down just because it's not relevant for the case. But in these particular instances, Rav Shachter has written his psak down. So we turn to page 6, to the bottom right-hand corner of page 6, and page 7, the English translation. This is dealing with the Epstein-Friedman case, which so many people know about. Tamar Epstein is 28 years old and has been waiting for a get since their separation in March 2008. So over 3.5 years. And Aaron Friedman is 35 and refuses to issue the get, and unabashedly is using the get as leverage for greater custody and visitation. And so this is a very good example where he hasn't gotten what he wants for custody and visitation, and we've said, go to civil court. Well, he went to civil court. He refused to go to Beit Din. It's a complicated background to the case, but in the end, he refused to go through the Beit Din process. He went to civil court. He was a plaintiff in the civil court matter to adjudicate custody and visitation. He didn't get what he wanted. He appealed the decision, and he still didn't get what he wanted. So he says, I'm not giving her the get until I get what I want. Now, he's a little bit of a subjective party. You know, he can't really make an objective decision about what's in the best interest of the child. That's how custody and visitation should be determined. What's in the best interest of the child, not what each parent wants. I like to use the example of Shlomo HaMelech, right? The two sort of prospective mothers or two women who come to Shlomo HaMelech and say, both say the daughter is ours, and sort of Shlomo HaMelech says, I'll cut the child in half. The parent who says, I want my share, I want my half of the share, is not a true loving parent. And Shlomo HaMelech knew that. And he said, the parent who wants what's in the best interest of the child, that's a true loving parent. So in this case, Aaron Friedman has refused to issue a get unconditionally, and the Beit Din process stalled. What sometimes happens, unlike there are national Bate Din and there are local Bate Din. And so local Bate Din are sometimes influenced by local pressures and things like that. And they often have fewer standards and procedures that are published. So in this case, the Beit Din process simply stalled. Even though the husband refused to eventually adjudicate the issues in Beit Din and he plowed through in civil court, nevertheless they refused to issue a psak or a seiruv against him. And then they dropped the case. The Beit Din dropped the case, but they also refused to now allow another Beit Din to take it on, which was very strange. And so this woman Tamar was stuck in this gridlock between Batei Din because she had a Beit Din that really failed her, but refusing to allow another Beit Din to take on the case. So Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky weighed in on this case and said this woman is an aguna and the husband is chayv legarish. He's required according to halacha to give a get. And we turned to Rav Shachter. Rav Shachter, without any he has no relationship in this case whatsoever, but he looked at the case and found out about the details of the case and said, I agree with Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky. What Rav Shachler has said to me is that once the marriage is irreconcilable and there's been a fair and sincere attempt at resolving the outstanding issues of the get, then there's absolutely no excuse for the get not to be issued, and the woman is an aguna. So in this case in particular, there were many attempts to resolve the case amicably, and they had finished the civil divorce process, but still the husband refused to go to to give the get, or certainly to have the issue adjudicated in Beit Din. And so Rav Shechter wrote this psak saying that not only has Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky weighed in on this case and said the woman is an aguna and the husband has to give the get, but I'm going to add my weight as well and say the same thing, and the husband is committing an isser. He's violating halacha by not giving again, and we have an obligation as a Jewish community to assist the husband in no longer violating halacha and to convince him that what he's doing is unacceptable according to halacha and to convince him to give a get. So that's one type of case where Rav Shachter has weighed in. That's a type B case, right? A situation where the Beit Din process has failed in the sense that it's stalled and has not come to a final conclusion, and Rav Shachter has weighed in on that case. If you turn back to pages... let me see which it is.
So,
it's an open case, and we have a protest rally a week from this Sunday in Silver Spring, Maryland. So thank you for asking about that. And I'll take more questions at the end, but thank you for clarifying that. In the end, also, a seruv was issued. We assisted the woman in navigating the Beit Din process. This was a year ago that Rav Shachler had written this psak. She eventually got a seruv from Beit Din, and he still refused to give the get. Going back to page 3, and I apologize, I don't have a translation of this psak. But this is a situation where when a Beit Din issues a Seiruv, an order of contempt, they generally say, look at, you know, this place in Shulchan Aruch, this Siman in Shulchan Aruch, and that Siman in Shulchan Aruch, and that's how you should treat the husband. The problem is these Simanim in Shulchan Aruch give a whole litany of possibilities in how a Beit Din might decide how to treat the husband, whether it's a Cherim or a Nidui or what have you. And so we've turned to Rav Shachter in passing for us, what does a Seiruv actually mean? What does it mean that a husband is contempt of Beit Din, and what can we do? And so in this particular case, the husband works at Judaica Plus in Cedarhurst. What's the main street on Cedarhurst?
Central
Avenue. Thank you. So Judaica Plus in Central Avenue. The husband's name is Chaim Chernikov. He's refused to give his wife a get for a few years. And there's a seiruv, an order of contempt against him. And so we've worked with the employer of Judaica Plus, and he was willing to fire his employee for not giving the get. And so we asked Rav Shachter, is that type of pressure permitted according to Allah or not permitted? And Rav Shachter wrote in this psak, that type of pressure is permitted, to threaten the husband that he'd lose his job if he refuses to give the get. And the last psak that we'll look at before we move on to the third section of this presentation, before I take some questions, is pages 4 and 5, which is, as I mentioned before, unfortunately, this is really something that bothers Rav Shachler to the core and me as well, but with my discussions with him, this is really what gets him, is unscrupulous batei din and rabbis who don't do what they're supposed to do and are not sympathetic to agunot and women suffer in this process. So in this case, you have an otherwise modern Orthodox couple, and if this couple would have chosen a Beit Din before they got married, in the prenuptial agreement, which will be the third part of this discussion, they would have definitely gone to the Beit Din of America. A good modern Orthodox couple. They would have gone to the Beit Din of America, the Beit Din, which is affiliated with Yeshiva University, with REITs, with the OU. But in this situation, the husband gamed the system, and he said, I'm not going to the Beit Din of America, which is a fair Beit Din. I'm going to go to a unscrupulous Beit Din in Brooklyn, which is known to favor men, and I'm going to insist on going to that Beit Din. And the wife said, well, I want to go to the Beit Din of America. And so that unscrupulous Beit Din in Brooklyn issued a seiruv, an order of contempt, against the wife for refusing to come to their Beit Din. But she said, hold on a sec. I have my right to go to my Beit Din, the Beit Din of America. That Beit Din said, we don't recognize those crazy feminist modern Orthodox rabbis at the Beit Din of America. Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, Rav Mordechai Willig, and Rav Yonah Ries, and Rav Michael Broy, they're not good enough for us. And they issued a seiruv against her. And so on behalf of this woman's shul rav, we asked Rav Shachter a shaila of, Well, what does a shul rav do when his wife has when a woman in this rav's community has a seirav against her from this beit din, given the circumstances of the situation? So Rav Shechter wrote unflinchingly about the fact that this seirav is completely off base, and the fact that the wife is willing to go to beit din, and considering the abuse that she has suffered and the factors that go into this case, the wife is undoubtedly an aguna. And again, the community should do whatever they can to try to pressure the husband to give the get. So that's another situation where Rav Shechter has weighed in. Finally, the last point that I'd like to discuss, which is the importance of the halachic prenuptial agreement. And this is, I'm sorry that it's not pull-outable, because you know it shares a side with a translation, but the last four pages of the handout is the binding arbitration agreement. It's the halachic prenuptial agreement from the Beit Din of America. You can go to theprenup.org and print out copies of this as well. So very briefly, what is the halachic prenuptial agreement? It has two parts, which combine into one agreement. The first part is that it's a binding arbitration agreement in which a couple signs before they get married, and you could also have a postnup, postnuptial, right? So you can sign this even if you're already married and make the same commitment. So a couple signs and says, in the event of a divorce, we agree to go to the Beit Din of America, at the very least to adjudicate the issues of the get. So that will avoid, just to start off with, the case that I just talked about, where the wife goes to Beit Din of America and the husband goes to an unscrupulous Beit Din in Brooklyn, and then you're dealt with this, you know, this battle for jurisdiction between the different Batei Din. So at the very least, it would avoid a situation like that. So the first part is a binding arbitration agreement. They agree to go to the Beit Din of America. The second part, and this is on page 2 of 4, in the highlighted section the italicized section of the binding arbitration agreement. The husband obligates himself to pay his wife what he's halachically obligated to do, which is to provide her food, clothing, and shelter for the duration of their marriage. So it says that from the date of their separation until their halachic marriage ends, i.e., until he gives a get, he's going to provide her with $150 a day, which is an average. It can be changed to $1,050 if that's your standard of living or what have you. $150 a day to cover her food, clothing, and shelter, $55,000 a year. This creates a financial disincentive for a husband to refuse to give a get. And we and the Beit Din of America have found the halachic prenup has been 100% successful in assuring that a get is given in a timely fashion. We've never had a case where a prenup was signed, or properly signed, and a get was withheld for an extensive period of time. A prenup was signed and a copy was extant. If we had a situation where a prenup was signed and the couple's house burned down, and that was one copy, and their second copy was with the rabbi who married them. The rabbi who married them was the husband's father, and he couldn't find the copy. So we suggest the couples either email or fax a copy of their signed agreement to the Beit Din of America, and they can store it in their digital files. But this has been very, very, very successful. And you're right, there's going to be a case where a husband says, I don't care, I'm going to pay their $55,000 a year. This will resolve 99.9% of our cases. And if we can resolve 99.9% of our cases, I can be out of business, which would be a great thing. Probably one of the few people in this economy looking to go out of business. Aura can go out of business, and we'll have the 0.1% of cases that are left in our community. But we go through our list of cases in our office, and I've done this, and said this case wouldn't be a case if the husband had this financial disincentive to give the get. In this case, wouldn't be a case either. So many cases would have been resolved before and had a halachic prenup been signed. What we're trying to propagate is that friends don't let friends get married without a prenup. Right? If you're in, you should share this with your friends and your children, that if someone says to you, I want you to be an aid kiddushin, I want you to be a bridesmaid, I want you to be a groomsman at my wedding, you say, great, I'd love to, thank you, you're my best friend, I'm so honored, as long as you sign a halachic prenuptial agreement. That's what we're trying to get out there, so it'd be social pressure from the ground up for everyone to sign halachic prenuptial agreements. Now, there are two primary forms of pushback that people give, or really, no, really one, but I'll give two answers to it. Forms of pushback that people give to signing the halakha prenuptial agreement. The first is that it's unromantic. Who wants to talk about divorce, and contentious divorce in particular, at the time of marriage? So I ask people, are you planning on doing a ketubah under the chuppah? And they usually say yes, right? At Orthodox marriage, we sign a ketubah. So I say, and where are you going to put the ketubah once you sign it? In our living room, up there, beautiful on the wall. And you're going to read it under the chuppah. Great. What does the ketubah say? The ketubah talks about death. It talks about what the husband's obligations towards his wife over the course of the marriage and after the marriage. That's what it talks about. Sounds pretty similar to the prenuptial agreement. If the prenup was written in Aramaic and had fancy, you know, colors around it, everyone would sign it without a problem. The problem is that it's written in English and it's a civilly enforceable agreement. It's a good thing, but that's people's hesitation. What I like to say, and I signed a halakha prenuptial agreement before I got married, is that the prenup is a statement that a husband is making to his wife, that I love you so much and I care about you so much that I never want to hurt you. Divorce brings out the worst in people, and otherwise great people, right, divorce brings out the worst in them. And so if someone can't say, I love and care about you so much that I never want to hurt you, then you shouldn't marry them. It's a terrible red flag. And so that's the statement that someone is making, that I'm signing the prenup because I love and care about you so much, that divorce happens in our community and contentious divorces happen in our community, but the get won't be used as leverage. That's number one. Number two, if you have a couple that's wonderful, wonderful people with wonderful, come from great families, and they're never going to get divorced, of course not, and when I sign a prenup, I don't intend to get divorced, and we didn't intend then, and we don't intend now. We have a wonderful marriage. But why do we sign a prenup? So besides for the other reasons, the second reason is because we want to inoculate the Jewish community from this issue. Again, divorce is a reality, and contentious divorces are a reality. If everyone signs this, we will essentially inoculate our community from this issue. We want it to be a standard. Just like a ksuba is a standard, so too signing the halachic prenuptial agreement should be a standard. So that's my spiel about the prenup. Again, we talked about the role that Ora plays in the types of cases that we take on. Rav Schechter and his how proactive he has been in our cases, and the importance of signing the halakha prenuptial agreement. So thank you very much. I'm happy to take any questions. Yeah. Hechadash asr min haTorah, right? Anything new is asr. It's a concern about innovation and new ideas and things like that. I had a conversation with a certain Rosh Yeshiva from a to the right of YU yeshiva, and it was for before someone's wedding, and I said, are you planning to do an halachic prenuptial agreement? And he said no, and I said, why not? And he said, because they shouldn't talk about divorce at the time of marriage. And I said, well, are you doing the, like, I went through the whole thing, are you doing a ksuba? He said yes. And I said, well, isn't the same thing? Well, you need the lawyers to sign it, this and that. I said, no, you don't need the lawyers to sign it. In New York State, the rabbi can even notarize it. Well, you shouldn't talk about the divorce at the time of marriage. I said, wait, we've already answered that question, right? It's just, you know, it's a resistance to change. What I feel is that the border between YU and the more yeshivish communities is a porous border. And so if we have all YU guys and all Stern girls and all Ritz Musmachim signing prenup, sometimes they marry Landers girls, and sometimes they, you know, the borders between the communities, between modern Orthodox and yeshivish and things like that, are porous enough that it, once it becomes a standard within the modern Orthodox community, within the YU community, it will spread to other communities as well. That's what I think. I think there's a prenup for everyone. Rav Moshe approved of signing binding arbitration agreements before marriage. With the specific issue of the $150 a day was not something that was asked of Rav Moshe, but Rav Avadi Yosef has endorsed the prenup. Rav Zalman Nechamin Goldberg has endorsed the prenup. Rav Asher Weiss has endorsed the prenup. So, like, major Haredi names have endorsed the prenup from a halachic perspective. There's at the very least some sort of prenup that anyone should be able to sign. You don't like Rav Willig's language of $150 a day is financial support, okay, at least sign a binding arbitration agreement to a reasonable, responsible, respectable beit din. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Number one, 25 years ago when I was volunteering with the cult of COLPA, okay, well, Bar Shikla, you called Julius Berman, was there, okay, yeah. Judith Dickelow was there, and one of the things that we, you know, you have like a dozen lawyers, you know, more, and we're all trying to do with prenup agreements, and Judith Dick. came up with one, you know, and this one came with another, trying one because that should be overturned because there's a very real danger in the wording of some. I haven't read this one. It could be taken to court. It could be overturned by a judge. It depends.
I mean, so far it's held up in civil courts. It's been challenged.
Yeah. And it came up with a possibility, okay? Possibly, I'm saying the lawyers were across the spectrum because basically everyone has arthritis. Okay, we're all on Israel, and every family has a spectrum. Let me tell you something. And the men went, to speak to different ones. And from a community and the Hasidic, certain Hasidic communities, I won't mention, said, you know, Taco, we have that problem. But if we hear that the conservatives or the modern Orthodox are going to okay the same, you know, agreement, you know, nishmam yeh. Okay.
Yeah.
The second thing, and another. You know, there were several different things.
They didn't develop their own,
no.
So what's the question specifically?
Because every family, let's say, every family has a spectrum, okay?
Right.
A spectrum, you don't know what, you know, what will turn out, what kid will turn out, what community they will go to. Even after they marry, people change. The second thing, and my husband and I feel very strongly about this, okay? And to our knowledge, only Rabbi Moshe Tendler, and perhaps Rabbi Willick, okay? If Rabbi Bonin will say, I will not be Masada Kedushin, and this is a run across yeshivas. I will not be Masada Kedushin unless, along with the Tanai and the Ketuba, there is a signed prenup agreement. And most Rabbanim, even Y.U. Rabbanim, will not force it. Okay.
They will not force it. So it's a good point.
Okay. So one case, one of my friends' daughter was getting married to a boy. Okay. She's from Burton County. The boy was from Queens. Okay. And everything was hunky dory at the future amount of time until they suggested, you know, go to Rav Willick for his agreement. Let me tell you something. The future amount of time in Queens, it was hell. You don't trust my son, etc., etc. There was always these ill feelings. If a Rav says, this is what's required, I will not perform. You know, you people say, okay, blame the Rav, just like they're claiming, blame, you know, my lawyer made me sign this, my doctor made me take this medicine. Do the same thing for Rav, and across the board, whether it's in the modern Orthodox community, the middle of the road, or the Haredi, Rabbanim aren't willing to say.
So there are even three RCA resolutions, Rabbinical Council of America resolutions, instructing rabbis to only be Masada Kedushin with a prenup. And there are some rabbis who will suggest it, some rabbis who won't suggest it, some rabbis who will require it. I feel that a community gets a rabbi they deserve. And that you know, communities appoint their rabbis, or you choose which community you live in. And rabbis also have to play, you know, are in certain positions, and it's not easy for rabbis to put their foot down. I'm excusing it to some degree. I think that rabbis should do this. If communities say, this is our standard, right? The fact of the matter is that we can complain, you know, from today till tomorrow about the fact that rabbis haven't made it a standard yet. So what can we do instead? We can start, instead of going from the top down, we can do it from the ground up. And we say this is a communal standard from amongst our community, amongst our friends, and that what parents insist to their children, and parents can sign postnups themselves and say, we signed a postnup, we want you to sign a prenup as an example for their children. And that's what they did in Riverdale. Rav Willig, they had a postnup party, and Rav Willig signed a postnup to make a statement for their community. So I think there's a lot more that we can blame the rabbis, but there's also a lot more, and you know, I think it's not always warranted. Because I think there's a lot more that communities have to do in making it a communal issue and saying this is a standard for our community. Was there another question? Yeah.
She asked the question.
Okay.
Oh, you answered that it's accepted to court.
Yeah, so there was a great article written by Michelle Greenberg Coburn, who's a dean at Columbia Law School, in 1999 on the civil enforceability of religious prenuptial agreements. And she made a number of strong arguments there, and it has held up in court so far, and we've every reason to believe that it will continue holding up in court. So far, all over. There are specific issues with California because they have prenuptial laws that are different than New York's prenuptial laws, so there's a California version of the prenuptial agreement, but you know, we anticipate that, just like any other agreement that you're going to sign that's been drafted by attorneys, it's going to be enforceable in civil court. Yeah. Was there anyone else who had a question? Yeah.
I don't know if you can answer, but is there a list of unscrupulous what they did that you...
it's a good question. It's more on a case-by-case basis. And look, we have cases across the religious spectrum, from non-Orthodox to Hasidic. So if a Hasidic woman calls me, I'm generally not going to refer to the Bezin of America, because it's just not a Bezin which is appropriate for her community. We'll try and navigate it elsewhere for her specific community. I'd recommend, particularly for this audience, the President of America. I think we trust him very much. Yeah, last question, and then we'll break.
Okay, number one, could you explain why one Beis Din has to hand off to another Beis Din?
So Bati Din generally work with the principle of comity, right? Not comedy, but comity, in which they recognize the rulings of another Beit Din. Otherwise, it's just like total anarchy and even worse ad hoc system. So yeah, that's what they do. They recognize the Piskei Din and the standing of other Bati Din, with the exceptions of in particular, I name three people: Shlomo Blumenkranz, Tzvi Dov Abraham, and Avram Gestetner. Gestetner and Abraham are in Muncie. Shlomo Blumenkranz, who's the brother of Avram Blumenkranz, Alav Shalom, who wrote the Pesach book, lots of chumras. So his brother was wrote lots of chumras, but Shlomo Blumenkranz is a Rasha. We had two protest rallies in front of Shlomo Blumenkranz's house. Rav Schachter led one of those protest rallies because Shlomo Blumenkranz assists husbands in extorting, using the get as leverage, and extorting concessions from their wives. So Blumenkranz, Abraham, and Gestetner, they all work together. It sounds like partners in a law firm, right? Blumenkranz, Abraham, and Gestetner. But the three of them work together, and that's known across the board. If a husband, says, "Oh, I'm going to Gestetner," all other Bati Din know that they don't accept it. So they're working on similar principles of comedy. In this one case, there's this kind of like out there rabbi in this particular case, who wouldn't accept the Beit Din of America. That's the exception rather than the rule. Generally, Bati Din accept the rulings and the standing of other Bati Din. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any of the questions you may have. Thank you. Let me see how I can. And your name again. I'm sorry.